Hey, kids.
You're listening to the internet's wettest podcast about video games, consoles,
and pancakes.
The SML Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining as usual, Chris, Pernell, and Aki. How are you three doing?
It's us.
Hey.
I'm kind of unhappy that I've become the someone who is considered usual on the Tuesday episode.
I mean, there's an easy way to fix
like
that.
All of them lately.
I know.
There's an easy way to fix that. Go back to Thursday.
Wow.
Yo, maybe I will.
Keeps you from doing drugs, right?
I'm kidding. I don't care for you. But, I mean, you're the one who say you don't want to be here. We don't mind that you're here. But if you don't want to be here, there's a place you can go. It's called Thursday.
Yeah, but half of Thursday's crew definitely don't fucking want me there. So.
Oh, come on.
Wow.
So maybe
come to Tuesday. I like how you phrased it specifically. Oh, I don't care that you're here.
I didn't say I don't care that you're here. I'm just saying, hey, you're welcome
Joe, rewind the podcast. Oh, okay.
I was like, I know you meant
I don't mind. We don't mind.
We don't mind. There it is. You know how I am. I'm not a jerk like that. But
no, of course I am.
But like, yeah. But with that said, she did say she didn't want to do it. But just say, don't hate on it. You should be comfortable here. We're a welcoming bunch. Just know. We have certain rules here, like Popcorn Tuesdays and Spaghetti Tuesdays, Cake Tuesdays,
Soda Pop Tuesdays.
Soda Pop Tuesdays, you know how it is. Yeah, see, so you can follow the rules, you're welcome. Hang out, chill, have some popcorn, play a game or something.
Yeah.
Aki's like, I don't know what the hell I just
be the point where I dictate I don't actually like popcorn.
Really?
Or particularly like spaghetti, for that matter.
I'm a little bit, I'm kind of the same myself. I'm like, take it or leave it with popcorn.
Popcorn is more like the thing I pivot to. Well, one is just a staple movie snack. And then two, it is like the better snack if I'm trying to be mindful of my health. But I still want to have a quote unquote unhealthy snack. Popcorn is like the better of the unhealthy snacks. So
it's better than candy. That's for sure. Yeah.
That's for sure. That and chips.
But then
nothing is better than candy. So like, that's also a thing.
There we go.
I mean, that's like people say, nothing beats cocaine. Well, yeah. I mean, you like cocaine because you're already on it.
Especially your heart.
Man, I love me some crack. Yeah, I get it. Crack is great if you're already using it.
Listen, delicious, even. I hear where I get where you're coming from on this crack thing.
I tried it once and I just couldn't stop. It was on. But yeah,
the Horror Acolyte has a very important question for us, asking, what exactly is the spaghetti policy?
You bring it, you eat it, and if you're Aki, you bring it and just leave it for the rest of us.
That would mean that I would have to bring it, and why would I have any to make to bring?
Because that's the policy.
Now this policy is FUBAR. As the head of HR, no.
I didn't say it was a fair policy. I said it was the policy. What a policy.
HR has decided to get rid of that policy right here, right now. I'm sorry.
You ascended to the role of head of HR and you didn't know about the spaghetti policy?
You ain't lying. What are you doing? What are you even doing?
Other things to worry about.
This is like some Peter Principle type stuff, right?
Okay, I don't know if it's that I'm not old enough to understand that reference or I just don't follow the same things you do. What is the principle whatever?
The Peter Principle.
Cool. Yeah, what the hell's that?
Hang on.
It's delicious.
So basically, the Peter Principle is where you've been at a place long enough that you get promoted to something you're not qualified for. So,
oh yes, like, that's exactly why I'm the head of HR 100%. Yeah,
like you were in the mailroom for like 40 years or something like that, and now you're like head of engineering, but you don't know about computers or something.
Yeah, okay, that's definitely,
you know, that's the Peter Principle. 100%. And
sweet Peter.
On the topic of spaghetti, anyone else notice that SpaghettiOs have gotten really bad over the recent years?
I haven't had them in a while, but every once in a while I eat them for nostalgia purposes. And
I never liked them. So
they are so soupy anymore.
Oh, they're not as thick. Yeah, I can see that being the case.
They got those meatballs. It's just bullshit.
Yeah, the meatballs.
Whoa! Watch your tongue. The meatballs are good. They were good.
They were good.
I like.
Maybe I'm just not a big meatball guy.
I mean, don't get me wrong, they don't taste as good as authentic, you know, hand-rolled meatballs or whatever, but they're meatballs from Franco-American. They did the job.
Okay, maybe I have, like, a unique perspective on this, because, like, I grew up with two parents who are excellent cooks, especially my dad. He could make, like, gourmet stuff, and so it's like, we didn't really eat, like, stuff like SpaghettiOs and everything growing up. It's like, we just had real spaghetti and meatballs, you know?
Well, there it is. I mean, that was the thing that we had where it was like, okay, you got to go to your grandma's house to be babysat while your mom was at work or whatever. And for lunch, it was basically SpaghettiOs. If we were lucky, that was the cool thing. Otherwise, it was there was also oodles and noodles if we were lucky. Or, that's funny you hear that, if you were lucky, you got oodles and noodles. And the alternative beyond all that was Campbell's soup. Chicken noodles.
I was just going to say, I can't wait to hear what the unlucky thing is. What is the shortest straw at the Purnell's grandparents' household?
Pure gruel. Sweet gruel.
Being stuck with the grandkids would be my guess.
Now, Grandma loved hanging out with us. I appreciate her for that. I used to play pity. That's how I learned how to play pity pat. And she's the one that got me to like hot sauce.
Oh, nice.
I eventually surpassed her taste in hot sauce by eating spicier and spicier things, but the OG Crystal in Louisiana, that was mom. That was grandma. So
that's good.
OG Crystal?
I like that stuff.
Is that meth again? Are we back to meth?
Oh, God. God damn it. No, it's not meth.
It might as well be, Joe.
It is that damn good. That is very true. But no, this is not the meth. This is not the meth, unless
it's just called Crystal Hot Sauce. You can look it up.
We're making a real meth of this episode.
Well, hopefully there's your title. Children's games in it.
There's this week's title. No, it's like Crystal is like a little bit like Tabasco in like consistency because it's very watery. But it's like a little less hot, I say, and a little more flavorful. Like it's got a little more flavor to it. And I like its flavor.
I've never been big into hot stuff.
Oh, okay.
My tongue burns
that makes
really
sense.
Easily.
That's the point. If you're an enjoyer.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. My man gets it. He gets it.
I mean, I'm only medium myself. I'm not like, I can't like take the stupid hot stuff, but it's like, you know, I kind of want to.
What's the hottest thing you've ever eaten, Purnell?
Probably the bomb hot sauce up there. There's one hot sauce I had where it was supposed to be a tablespoon per 1 gallon of water or some trash like that. But we ate it straight out of a little, like off of a toothpick because we didn't want to mix it with anything, and it was murder hot. I've had Jake Melnick's, which I'm not sure if it's a place that exists anymore, but their wings had me sweating in a fireman's hat. And those are I would say those are the hottest things because there's a certain point where I just stop because if I'm not near a toilet, that's my own personal toilet. There are certain things I will not eat just flat out. So.
You mentioned the bomb. Did they make you take that at a VGM con?
It's not even about make. Every time I go to VGM con, I always end up walking into the room just as they're about to do it. And I was like, oh, here we go. I'm in. And I just jump in. But I've never known when the panel was happening. I never seek it out. I just walk into it when it's happening.
It's fate.
And I get my stuff. It's fate and it's delicious.
Yeah.
So how was VGMCon? Chris, you performed there. How was it?
I did. VGMCon was excellent. It's actually, it's kind of like what I think I've been looking for this whole time with MAGFest. It's like something a little bit more medium-sized. Definitely like laser focused on video game music, instead of just being like, you know, all around con, and cheaper. Not just because I performed there, I had to buy a ticket for Catherine, and it was very affordable. Not all my favorite people, but a lot of my favorite people were there, and I got to meet Purnell.
Yay!
Hooray! He's muted, so.
No, well, only because I was texting my brother, and you don't want to hear all that. But yes, it was nice meeting you. I wasn't in my full best state of mind there, but even with that being the case, you can't deny the fact that VGMCon is a good time. Very quiet, low key, but you're getting as much good music. I mean, someone might argue that I don't care, but you know, I would say you get as much good music there as you would at MAG, because you might hear someone say something like, well, there's so many more bands. Like, yeah, but you can't attend them all. And there's plenty of good music playing it all weekend. So
that's exactly the point, is that it is the equal amount to, in fact, probably more. Well, they don't do Thursday, but they do Sunday. So,
yep.
Hard to say, but it's like, yeah, you can only listen to like one thing at a time, you know? So it's like, I disagree with that statement.
You can listen to a lot more than one thing at a time.
Not when there's two concert rooms across the hotel from each other.
Oh, well,
that and I actually want to enjoy my music when I listen to it, so I want to listen to one thing at a time.
Yeah. And it was fantastic. It's, you know, the bands I didn't get to see, I was like, so regretful. Whereas it was, you know, there wasn't like really a time where it was like, oh, here's a lull so I can just go out and eat or something. It's like every time I was not listening to music felt like a sacrifice.
Like my panel was during your time.
We were
going to work. During the one-ups play, I had a panel, so I couldn't even go to that. Like, there was nothing I could skip because it was during my panel. It's like, you gotta be kidding me.
So this may come out on video later, and I'm not even sure if it was supposed to be a surprise or anything, but Mustin gave you, Joe, a shout-out on stage.
I heard. I haven't seen any footage of the shout-out, but I did get a recording of the song, which was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was very nice. I couldn't enjoy the song fully because the very next song was the one I had to play a bass solo on.
How nice.
So, Mustin invited myself and I'm going to say 8 or 9 other people. I could sit here and list them, but I don't know what the exact number is off the top of my head, but like a bunch of people to come up and do like a conveyor belt of solos, right? So like, you know, the one, they had them staggered out where one person could be getting ready whilst one other person was soloing, like, because they were different instruments and stuff. And I was one of the 3 bass soloists, along with Darmok and Tony Dickinson. And the thing. Yeah. I was not going to follow up Tony Dickinson on, you know, his 6-string bass stuff. Oh, no. I was after Darmok, actually. And she did a great job, too. But yeah, I was not going to, like, be, like, I'm like, yeah, here's my bass solo, and had Tony Dickinson get up there and, you know, really show off. So I was like, I'm going to do a little bit of a cheat. So I brought my Sidewinder Bass 6 from home, packed a whole other guitar just so I could play it for that solo. And what it is it's a bass, but it's the same tuning as a guitar, a standard guitar, right? 6 strings, you know. E-A-D-G-B-E, same tuning as a guitar, but they're bass strings. So it's perfect for if, like me, you grew up learning how to play guitar solos, but not bass solos. And so I ripped out a guitar solo on a bass, essentially, and folks were confused enough that I don't think anybody had any other feelings about it. So I feel like I got away with it. And then some people were like, what was that instrument? And I was like, it's a bass 6. Yeah, so that was what I did. And it was very fun. Yeah, it was really fun to jam with the one-ups for like 15 seconds.
Is there a bass or a guitar for a person who grew up eating Campbell's soup, though, is the question.
I feel like a bass six, I don't know. It's like, it's, I think it mostly makes its home in like rockabilly and like maybe kind of indie stuff. Like Robert Smith of The Cure plays one sometimes. The two of the Beatles played them on some of their recordings. Basically, if it was John or George playing bass, they were playing a bass six that Fender made back in the day because that was a more comfortable instrument for a guitarist. Yeah, so it's a cool guitar thing. It's just I picked it up because there's some specific like VGM stuff I want to cover that needs that kind of setup, at least in my ears. So like, you know, it was meant to like pick up and record with, but you know, again, when I was asked to solo, I was like, well, I'm more comfortable soloing on this thing that I've had for 1 month than the bass I've had for 5 years, so I'm gonna do that.
So you already may have said it, and I may have missed it. If you did, I'm sorry. But what was this? Considering that you said now this is like pretty much the thing you were looking for, what would you say is your favorite? What was your favorite part of, you know, VGM Con as being your first one?
Ah, man, yeah, that's a tough one. I haven't said. God, I mean, it was all the shows. You know, a lot of my favorite bands I haven't seen in a long time were playing. So it was like I hadn't seen the 1UPs in a long time. So that was really, really great. The Returners played and I wasn't playing with them this time. They had their original bassist for the whole set. So it was really, really nice for the first time in actually years seeing like, you know, what I consider my sister band, you know, playing a full show with that, with me just being there enjoying it. Vic Viper was also a big highlight. They were the very, very, very last band to play. So they played for only like half the crowd. They actually got down on the floor. They took the amps to the front of the stage, got on the floor and did it house party style.
Nice. Walk that dinosaur.
Yeah, yeah. And they threw in a couple of new tunes. If you're not familiar with Vic Viper's album, definitely go find it on Bandcamp. It's really, really honest, like two, you know, guitar, keyboard, bass, and drum covers of like usually NES stuff, but like there's some SNES stuff too, but really clean, accurate covers. And yeah, they did all their album stuff, as far as I know, and then they included something like, you know, they like to do obscurity, so they did King Kong Ikari no Megaton Punch, which is King Kong 2, colloquially known as a Konami action game on the NES. It was really cool, and they did some music from that, and he was like, nobody's going to know what this is, and I was like, I know!
I like when bands do that, to be honest with you. I really appreciate when it's like, you know, we made this because we like it, and we hope you appreciate it, too. And if someone in the audience likes it and knows what it is, too, bonus.
Yeah. I was like, I never knew anybody that covered it, but I definitely know it, because it's a Konami soundtrack on the NES. It's like I've listened to a lot of those.
Like, hey, buddy, you ever heard of a little thing called Storm Eagle?
Right. You ever heard of this Mega Man? Yeah. Also Kirby's Dream Band, fantastic. I got to see Ian Cowell and the Band of Exceptional Goblins. I saw half of their show because I had to leave for another thing. And then in the half that I didn't see, they played freaking Booger Man. And
whoa.
Y'all know I'm all about that soundtrack, so I regret to have missed that. Steel Samurai, also incredible. Really enjoying
good
that
lineup this year.
I know, fantastic lineup. Couldn't at some point the thing that was on right before Super High Tops, I say thing because it's an entire opera with an orchestra, is Aria Kart. So it's a Mario Kart musical, but it's with a entire orchestra, and so whoa. they had to rope off a lot of the. A lot of the floor for the musicians to get down there and play their classical instruments. So the room actually hit capacity and they had to turn people away.
Wow.
I don't think I've ever seen that happen there. Like, I've seen the room get crowded, but at best you just see people blocking out that taped out box and having right. people squeeze in further. But I've never seen them straight up say, you can't come in here. So that's yeah. impressive.
Well, I mean, it is because of the amount of musicians. It was like 60 musicians in there.
Jesus.
Yeah, I made a joke at the High Tops set that we have our song Sonic 3-2-1, which is our Sonic the Hedgehog covers, and I said it's called 3-2-1 because when we get to one, we're gonna raise this curtain and there's gonna be 60 more musicians. And folks laughed.
Oh,
but yeah, our set was really good, and people really, really liked it. We had a couple of guests, including a trumpeter. Little did I know that one of Kevin, our guitarist's brothers, both his brothers were there, and one of them is an accomplished trumpet player, and he got some sheet music from Wedge, our keyboardist, and was able to just hang with us. No rehearsal needed.
That's awesome.
Nice.
Yeah, so we got to play. We introduced our first track from Toe Jam and Earl, Panic on Funkatron, which is called Ode to Charla. That one that's really great. And he played horn on it, or a trumpet on it. And I'm like, damn, can we get him down in Texas so we can do a video?
With enough hoping and dreaming, you can make it happen.
Yeah.
And a bunch of
then
money.
Past that, it was just tons and tons of hangouts.
I was lucky enough to be able to briefly partake in a hangout as on, I believe, Saturday night at 3 in the morning. William Reyes is like, you awake? I said, chilling in bed, dozing off. He's like, can we video call you? Wake up, bitch.
Damn.
I said, who's all there? My wife will kill me. He's like, she won't kill you. Me, Mustin Flick, Jared, Tony Dickinson, some others. So they called us, and
well, that's
just
very
had
sweet.
A video call at 3 in the morning.
Yeah, that's really great. Nice. It goes to show that you were definitely missed there to the point where they outright reached out to you, and you got a dedication on stage. So you've made your mark, sir. You've made your mark.
Yeah, I wish I could have been there, but...
Well, hopefully there's next time for all of us.
Hope so.
I'm definitely planning on going either way if I can. Like, I'm probably going to intentionally skip MAGFest again and just focus on VGMCon, you know?
I would definitely say that's the smarter play, especially in your case, because both of those are decently far, so it's not like one's reasonably closer, so...
No, yeah, they're both pretty unreasonable, I know, because I drove.
Yeah, so if I was choosing between the two, and it wasn't a skin off my back either way, I would definitely choose VGMCon over MAGFest. But don't say that too loud, because that'll ruin VGMCon.
Right. Yeah, we don't want it to get too popular. But,
Nice and relaxed.
Yeah, no, it was great. I loved it. 10 out of 10.
Nice.
Buy it.
Speaking of that, should we get to reviews? We got a handful of games to talk about tonight.
Sure. Why not? Why the heck not?
One question before we do that.
Sure.
How's your arm feeling, Joe?
Oh, it's so shitty.
It's still bugging you? Like, did you, like, I know you said they didn't give you anything like an anti-inflammatory or anything like that, but I would have thought you'd have had like a call back, say, yo, just whatever you're doing, it ain't working. Come up with something better by now or something, because it hasn't even gotten less painful. Like,
It's getting better, but it still hurts to do like anything with my right arm. Like, when I'm just sitting here, it's not.
In other words, he's not allowed to fap.
Yeah, Jacob didn't make that joke a dozen times already. I'm pretty sure it's a partially torn bicep. The bicep still hurts. It goes down into my forearm. The pain radiates all the way up into my neck now. It's just... sucks. It friggin' sucks. And I can't even play games.
Oh, that's definitely got to be a crappy thing. RPGs, I guess. Use your left hand and just toggle between the buttons when you need to.
I was going to say, Earthbound is good for one hand.
It is.
You can use L and select. Yeah. So there you go. Replay Earthbound. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully, I have a follow-up on the 6th, I think. I don't know. We'll see.
That is goes. Not soon enough. Jesus.
I still have to do physical therapy. I haven't started it because my arm is just throbbing too much that I don't want to start, like, brutalizing it with physical therapy.
I mean, I'll be honest with you. I'd almost still consider going in just to see if the person that's working with you has better suggestion. Like, they're like, try moving this. Like, it doesn't work. They might go, based on that, I'd recommend doing this. Basically, more than your doctor's apparently done for you, so.
Yeah.
Like, that was me when I hurt my back last year. Like, I'm actually glad, like, I'm still not 100%, but I'm like 80-85%. But back then, I couldn't even sleep. And I forced myself in the PT despite being in pain. And it does help, even if you're not initially there with it yet. So, something to consider.
Yeah. I don't know. But we got games to talk about. Let's talk about those.
Okay.
Yay.
I guess so.
First game to talk about tonight is The 100 Line Last Defense Academy, developed by Tukio Games and MediaVision, published by Aniplex, released April 23rd on Switch and Steam for $59.99. 15 students are tasked with defending a school from grotesque monsters for 100 days. Can they make it to the end, and will they survive long enough to uncover the truth? For now, what is The 100 Line Last Defense Academy?
So this game is the baby of two interesting creators, the one that was originally behind the Danganronpa games, and another who was behind games like 999, Virtue's Last Reward, and Zero Time Dilemma. They came together to make this game under 2Q Games, and without going into nuts, apparently this is like a really big deal, as in like this is a make-or-break title for them. Though with that said, it's easy to understand why once you settle into it and see what they're producing for you as the player. So the narrative is about as ridiculous as you'd expect from a guy, from people that between the... I'm so freaking tired. Their narrative is about as ridiculous as you'd expect from the two people that made the games I described earlier, or mentioned earlier. You play as a character by the name of Takumi, who lives in a dome city. Peaceful life within this dome city with his family and friends. Nothing ever seems to be different and out of the ordinary until that weird day where something out of the ordinary happens. Because even though they live in a world where they occasionally have like bomb shelter calls and they just feel mundane to them, an event occurs one day where monsters show up into town and just start pretty much massacring the citizenry. And as you are running lost and scared, trying to escape from these things, with your best friend, an event occurs resulting in a near-death experience until this little weird ghostly man with a top hat or bowler hat shows up named Siri, and he pretty much suggests that if you want to help your friend and help yourself, you can do so by stabbing yourself in the chest with a knife that he hands to you. Hmm. The game offers you the choice of whether or not you wish to do it, and I considered pushing no, but was like, nah, I want to go on with this game. I'm fine with it. So I said, sure. And an event occurs as a pretty cool, like, bloody magical girl sequence of sorts, and then you're tasked with fighting. I'll go into what battles are like later, but after the battle's over, you are quickly thrust into what's known as the Last Defense Academy, which is what you described in the intro of the show. At this point, you'll immediately start to notice similarities to one of the aforementioned games, being Danganronpa. A lot of characterizations of certain individuals, the way they display them on the screen, and their personalities. Very extreme, like, I don't know, like, personality quirks, so to speak. They take up the majority of a character type to give you an impression of who they are. You get that aspect. You also get the way they're displayed. You get good music by, because that's the same composer as Danganronpa also. There's even a character that references Killing Games all the time, almost to the point of being kind of annoying. It's like, I get it. You're referencing your old shit. It's okay. But beyond that, you have an interesting narrative plot where you're being told that in order to save the world and also those you care about, you have to survive 100 days in the Last Defense Academy, protecting it from all comers, as well as whatever may be, and out there in addition to the enemies you fought in town. This is done through a series of narrative beats, where you will talk to characters in your free time, learning more about them, and also by talking to them, leveling up certain stats in your character. They are generally referred to as like studies or like school, you know, curriculums, as well as social aspects like gym or social studies. Why? I have no idea, but it's okay because it's fun. And you use these things to eventually upgrade your character, as well as getting resources, which again, I'll talk about in a little bit, to upgrade your character, get new abilities and more attack power and stuff in the main battles in a certain facility in the school. And basically, that's the primary aspect of your free time. But in addition to that, you can also go on expeditions out in the wild, which is basically best described as a sort of board game. I want to say it takes some elements from the Danganronpa summer adventure game they did as a side project, where you move around the board using movement cards. And then once you land on certain spots, events occur, potentially battles occur as well, where you can get resources, which can also be applied to upgrading characters and events back at the school or at the academy. But when you're not dealing with the plethora of visual novel content and this exploration thing, you'll be engaging in battles. The battles can take place in a number of ways regarding whether the goal is to protect the walls of the school from adversaries that are trying to destroy the barrier that protects it, or it might be protecting an object or just defeating all the enemies while not letting yourselves get destroyed. The combat in this game is a tactical RPG. Not too complicated, but it's just the right amount of fun or depth to make it engaging, and it's also pretty freaking fun, too. Every character, just like their personalities, has their own battle archetype as well. That determines the types of attacks they get, their sort of character class, like you might have a tank character or a healer character or a ranged fighter. You have a situation where at the beginning of a turn, everybody gets to do their basic attack. There's no speed setting or anything like that, but your attacks are governed by an AP gauge. The AP is shared by every player on the board, and different attacks take up certain amounts of AP, and the moment you run out of AP, your turn is over. However, there are certain ways to get additional AP if you fulfill certain conditions in battle, such as killing the right enemies. In addition to that, as you take on damage, or give damage, you will increase your voltage gauge. The voltage gauge is sort of a metric that can be used to trigger additional effects and abilities, such as one where you pretty much do not a screen clearing, but a wide area clearing attack that could potentially do lots of damage. There's another version that you get if you get the gauge a little bit higher, where you can pretty much give yourself stat buffs that are lasting pretty much the duration of the battle. And I can't remember if it was through voltage or through losing too much health, but you can also do an attack that will straight up kill you. If you use the attack, you'll do tons of damage at the cost of your own life. Though I won't explain why, because that's a narrative reason. Don't sweat death too much in this game. It's part of the process. So that's the mechanic there. I should also mention that I do like the way AP works in this game, because in addition to how I mentioned that everyone shares the AP, every character can use as much AP as they technically want. However, the game decided to limit overusing one particularly strong character, if you have one, by making it so that when that character uses an attack, they become fatigued. And now, even though they can still do another attack, they can only move one space. So you can't, you know, blitz around the board and just use the same guy to massacre every character on the board, unless you find some really cool strategy to bring everybody together and just go to Pound Town, but then you're just kind of wasting your time. The thing about this game that makes it particularly engaging to me is the fact that, for the most part, aside from the typical visual novel tropes of, like, you know, unlocking more air, or I mean, not visual novel tropes, but Danganronpa-esque tropes, you will engage in, like, you know, opening up other areas of the location you're staying at to access to more events and the like. It's the fact that this game does eventually, without going into spoiler territory, unlock elements that will remind you of Virtue's Last Reward. Very wonderful features that will result in you coming back to the game more and more because you want to see what you may have missed, what you could still do, what have not done. And I think that is a particularly great aspect of this game. But even if that wasn't an aspect of it, just the actual play that you get leading up to anything like that is a lot of fun. I like the characterizations. I like that this game hits you with the right number of mysteries that you want to stick on board and figure out what the hell is going on. Because like these guys do, like they did in all their previous games, they give you these really weird premises. And even if you might be able to tell yourself, oh, I've seen something like that in the past. Hell, you could say that about Danganronpa. Trapped in a school, can't leave until X, blah, blah, blah. Been there, done that. Doesn't matter because the characterizations are great. The writing is great. The music is great. And the systems, albeit simple, are engaging enough that you want to keep engaging with those things as well. It's a good time. So much so that between me liking the game and the fact that, like I told you earlier in the review, that this is, it's been rumored that if this game does poorly, this company's going out of business. I did that rare thing I do on this show where I went out and bought the collector's edition after reviewing the game because I want to support this game. And I can tell you right now, if I didn't have, if I didn't believe in this game, I would not have wasted $100 doing that. So, it goes without saying that I think this game is fantastic. And for those people that are saying, because I've seen people online make these comments, maybe it'll fail and we'll get Danganronpa 4. Just shut up. I don't care. Danganronpa was great, but I'm glad it's done. The guy deserves to move on to something else. Let the series die. They wrote a perfectly good conclusion, so much so that it pissed people off because it was like, this is me saying there will never be another game. It's over. And I respect that. This game hits a lot of the notes that you missed from that game. And I do believe that if you're willing to give it a chance, you will find yourself going, it's no Danganronpa 4, but it's just as good or potentially even better than that because it's something fresh and new. I approve.
All right, well, it's a $60 game. Your official verdict?
Well, easily I'd buy it. I paid
$100. It's always good when a game is that good.
Yeah, it is.
All right, next up, Orphans, developed and published by Infinity Gear Studios. Released April 18th on Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch, PS4, PS5, and PC for $19.99. Dive into this immersive adventure, stealth, and puzzle game, taking on the role of Victoria, a young girl orphaned after a tragic sea accident, trapped in the enigmatic confines of a mysterious city. In a place full of traps and dangers, Victoria must rely on her dexterity to advance. Aki, what is Orphans?
Okay, Orphans is a stealth game where you play as a young girl. This place is coming all the fuck apart. You start off in a building with a fire in front of you just to keep you warm, and you head out and you find yourself a little lion mask, and then you're told, you're the lioness. You must save us all. And then you start running because there's nothing else to do with your time. And very quickly you find out that this world is inhabited by humans and by other things. I think these are metaphorical. I don't think they're actually supposed to be literal other things, but I don't care. For instance, you know, there's a lot of enemies who end up being, they're mice people. And they will eat you if they catch you, so don't get caught. And throughout this entire time, you're stealthing your way around the enemies, be them rat people, dog people, cat people, a giant whale with a human face, which is one of the creepiest things. You're also trying to solve little puzzles. Most of them are pretty simple. Oh, there's a key here. Let's pick it up. Oh, now I have to go chase after this thing. Oh, the key's standing right there. Let's go pick it up. Yeah, that's the typical difficulty of most of the puzzles in this. Some of the harder ones involve other characters that you meet, other children who are wearing masks of other individuals, and each one of those masks fit that individual. Like, there's a monkey boy, and he climbs up things, he helps boost you up places, he'll hang from stuff, and you can jump on him, and he'll fling you to the other side, like it's, you know, a trapeze artist. There's an elephant kid who's really strong and can just barrel through walls, stuff like that. And you use their abilities to basically help you traverse through the area and solve tiny little puzzles just to get you out of that next area, which is kind of funny that you keep getting out of the next area by basically leaving these other people that have helped you get out there. Just so twisted. But yeah, there's sadly not a lot to say about this game. It is one continuous level, basically. It's split between chapters. Apparently there's supposed to be 3 chapters in it. I don't know where they begin or end, because there's like not a screen necessarily that's like chapter 1 here. Instead it all just very, very well flows right into the next thing, because it's all side scrolling. You do have the ability to go forward and backwards and all 4 cardinal directions, but the world you traverse basically going left to right, which is kind of interesting. So yeah, there are some issues with it. Namely, there's some issues where you just fall through the ground because there's some issues with collision. Or there's also some where if you die or if you quit out of the game and go continue it, in some places it kind of screws up what you've done because it doesn't keep track of that as well as it should. For instance, there's a point in the game where you are put in prison and you basically open all the gates to let all the other prisoners out so you can escape. Well, if you happen to quit out of the game after doing that before you get to the next area, the riot has still started, so you can't interact with the button to start the riot again. However, all the doors that should be opened to start the riot, they're all closed again, which requires you to, restart the entire game all over because there's not a chapter select. Yeah, that's one of the last couple of chapters in the entire game, and there's a reason why I know that happens. So yeah, they are currently working on patches for that. They're hoping to have stuff like that fixed, including having it fixed to where the continue button is the first thing that is selected when you start the game up, because that's also really easy to accidentally click to go into a new game, and that gets rid of your save immediately. So, and I know that for a reason too. This game, I did not have a lot of luck with this game, this game, sadly.
Well, we got to talk price on it. It is a $20 game. Is it worth it, or does it need some fixes? What are your thoughts?
You definitely wait for fixes no matter what, because this game really needs them. However, $20 is kind of a hard sell. If it was like a $10, $12 game, I would say totally. So at 20, I would say wait for a sale. It's okay-ish, especially if you like stealth games. If you don't like stealth games, you're not going to like this. It's not going to do it for you, because this isn't particularly amazing stealth. So, yeah.
All right. Moving on, next game is Sacre Bleu, developed by Hildring Studio, published by Noodle Cake, released April 17th on Switch and Steam for $14.99. Fast-paced bullet time action platformer with speedrunning and revolutionary flair. Hack and slash your way out of La Bastille, blasting yourself through the air in a graceful bullet time aerial battle on a quest to save all of France. Chris, what is Sacre Bleu?
That's how you would say it, because it's very exaggeratedly French. So this is a interesting challenge platformer that has some bullet time action, as they say. So basically, you play as a musketeer who is captured and thrown into prison. There he meets a deranged old woman who enlists his help to help her with her experiments that will, get you out of prison at some point. The way you do that is by grabbing up parts from all the different, like, basically I guess you kind of have a way out of prison because there's like all these doors that you go into. It's, you know, it's set up a little bit like a Mario 64 situation. Like you go through a door and now you're in like this level and, you know, but there's a hub that you return to once you're done with that level. Excuse me. But either way, you're not supposed to worry about that so much. The actual action has your little guy running around, and he runs and does a little tiny jump. It's like nothing to write home about at all. He is no Mario. You know, you also have like you start off with 3 hearts, so you can take 3 hits, which is very nice. I like platformers where you don't die instantly. But yeah, like for your jump. So what you actually end up doing, this is kind of like how the game is. Your character has a blunderbuss. A blunderbuss is a is an ancient gun that basically, you know, like a really short range shotgun, essentially, from the ancient days. Like those are the kind of guns that, like, you know, half the time they wouldn't even fire. So, you know, you know, they're kind of crap. So, but in this game, what you do is you shoot like the ground and it propels you upwards, and you have 3 shots. So you essentially have a triple jump that you can kind of control the trajectory of in the air, thanks to the fact that like everything you do, like basically goes into bullet time. So you have that. And as you platform using your tiny jump and your blunderbuss, you also have a sword that you can swing around like any game where you swing a sword. I don't have to describe that, I don't think. But you have basically like, you know, you eventually you get like other types of things that you can do as well, but you know, for the most part it's just swinging the sword or holding it down to do like a multi swing, which helps like a sword spin, essentially like Zelda like which helps with enemies that have shields. What also helps with enemies that have shields is a freaking gun. So you have a musket and you can just shoot people, but of course the maximum amount of bullets you can carry is 10, because this is old times. And so, you know, you kind of have to watch that. So you have like all this arsenal of stuff, and then you have just like a zillion like moves. Oh, and there's also grenades. You can use, like, you can throw bombs, and you can either throw them at a trajectory or plant them. But if you plant them, you might also take damage too, because they'll like, they might instantly explode as soon as somebody's near them. I had trouble with bombs. I blow it up a lot. But yeah, like a ton of stuff is basically how you would describe this game in a nutshell. So, you know, that's already a lot of things I just described, but that is not even getting close to like all the different ways that you can interact with the environment, with enemies, all the different things you can do to incapacitate them, or get over like platforms and things. They literally paint like instructions all over the walls for like several, like, I don't know, as many levels as I played, they had instructions written on the walls for different things that you can do. So yeah, lots of different stuff there. One thing that's like an example is that, so there are archers in the game and they shoot arrows at you, and like, okay, well, dodge the arrow and then shoot them in the face, or try to get close enough to stab them in the face, right? Why not use your blunderbuss to shoot the arrow and completely reverse its trajectory so that it hits the enemy instead? Aha, aha. See, so that's a common move. Same thing with grenades. There are machines, like cannons kind of things, that like shoot grenades at you. Well, you can use your blunderbuss to blow those grenades back at the where they came from and blow up everything. To help you stay creative and fresh with the things that you can do to these enemies, because again, you could just stab them or shoot them. That's always an option, unless they have some way of protecting themselves. There's actually a score system, so you get ranked every time you're in a fight, and you get like combos and stuff like that, awards for that, lots and lots of awards in this game, achievements, even online leaderboards. So, you know, you can do like, you can go back through stages like constantly and just practice getting like the best score in every way. Or like I said, you can just go through the adventure and, you know, pick up the pieces. On top of those achievements, every stage has a set amount of secrets, just squirreled away little rooms where you raise a little flag and it tells you secret one of three unlocked or something like that. So yeah, lots and lots to do in this game besides simple platforming. And yeah, the graphics are really, really nice. They all appear to be hand-drawn and very cartoony. The sprites are a little on the small side because, again, this is a challenge platformer. We'll get to that in a second. But yeah, the background's amazing. Everything is like animated. You know, there's just stuff constantly moving all over the screen. Your little character is very cute. You know, he does his little grunts and stuff while he's doing everything. And if you die, then it will throw a French exclamation at you, and then it will just put you basically at the beginning of like maybe about 10 feet back, you know, like, and there's infinite lives, so you don't have to worry about like having to restart, because again, it's a challenge platformer, not like a traditional platformer necessarily. But yeah, you die and it'll be like sacre bleu, and then you're like, you know, end up back there, or it'll be like zut alors, or you know, mort, you know, like just different. It has like a pretty large lexicon of like different French curses that you know, that it can throw your way. So that's pretty fun. And the reason why I know there's so many is because there are a lot of sections in the game where you will die lots and lots and lots, and those are specifically the challenge platforming sections. On top of having action that's really cool and like I said, graded, and like, you know, having secrets to uncover and, you know, tons of personality. Sadly for me, this game also has the, you know, the inevitable spiky rooms of death, where you have to use that blunderbuss and, you know, do perfect precision shots to like end up, you know, grabbing onto the right ledge, and, you know, then something else unlocks and there's more floaty spiky blocks of like whatever, and, you know, thanks Limbo and Celeste for making all games like this now. they're well put together, and I didn't find anything I couldn't get through. It's just, I feel like that slowed the game way down for me. I went from having like a great streak of like all these battles and I found all the secrets in the stage to then suddenly dumping about 30 or 40 lives into a spiky section. So that's there too, just in case you were wanting to know. But yeah, like I said, Sackler Blue is just a ton of game here.
Oh, well, it was a $15 game. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, spiky pits notwithstanding, or spiky whatevers. Yeah, this is a well worth it game. It's clearly made with a lot of love and a lot of attention to detail. And although I did manage to break it once, I actually took a video of it. I went through the ceiling of something because I didn't quite know what to do. It had arrows pointing to things, but I didn't quite know what it expected of me. So I ended up blunderbussing myself through the roof in a section I don't think I was supposed to go through. And then I jumped off the ledge because I was like, maybe there's something down below here, and then I just jumped, you know, I fell into the X zone. And I was like, well, I better turn it off, I guess, because screen ain't getting any bluer. So yeah, you know, despite all that, yeah, it's a well-meaning game and certainly not expensive, so definitely give this one a try, or just straight up buy it if you're into challenge platformers. It's worth it.
Cool, sounds good. Yeah. Up next, Phantom Breaker Battlegrounds Ultimate, developed and published by Rocket Panda Games, released April 17th, Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch, PS4, PS5, and PC for $24.99. Phantom Breaker Battlegrounds Ultimate is a side-scrolling beat-em-up with the heart of a fighting game, showcasing nostalgic pixel art and the latest cross-platform online multiplayer. Experience the biggest and most expansive entry in the Phantom Breaker Battleground series to date. Brunel, tell us about it.
So, if you were around for the Xbox 360 era, you may have come across the original version of this game when it released towards the back end of that system's life, I would say. And on that system, full disclosure already, I thought it was a fantastic game. I played it and finished it with multiple characters, at least two of them, let's be specific, Makoto and the maid character. But here we are with this game again. A title that I did not expect to see get a return trip almost a decade later. But here we are. So the question is it any freaking good? Or is it worth it? Well, let's go into the description of the game. Narrative-wise, it ain't worth writing home about. I ain't gonna go into that. Basically, friends trying to save the friend of one of the characters, and rather the sister of the character, Waka, from Phantom.
Ooh. Waka Waka.
Hey, Fozzie! So, to do that, you choose from one of four characters in Makoto, Waka, Yuzuha, and Itsuki. Itsuki being the original maid character I mentioned before. And you're playing through a series of stages to get her back. Each level is essentially a beat-em-up with a foreground and a background. Think Guardian Heroes, if you ever played that back in the day. Your character can leap between them freely. And combat, while you're doing so, engages three buttons, basically a light, medium, and heavy attack. And then a special attack being the fourth button. You'll pretty much be mashing those buttons. There are move inputs you can put in to do certain types of attacks and pull off combos. To be perfectly frank, I found a certain set of moves that worked for me, with the exception of the general special moves, I just went ham on it, which is pretty much what I would do in any other beat 'em up game. So that is not a dig on the game. That's just me saying I knew my roots and I utilized those roots to kick ass and take names. Generally, levels engage you going from left to right, but sometimes right to left. And enemies, whoa, baby. At any given time, the screen will be flooded with a multitude of enemies. It could be small guys that are just pretty much there to be beaten the stuffing out of. Like, there's scenarios in normal difficulty where with the small fries, I've stood in one place and waited for one of them to punch me because I wanted to practice guarding. And it was like, come on, man, hit me. But then you'll come across the heavies, the flying guys, the other flying guys that have propellers and can fire projectiles. Those guys are assholes. and then so many more types of enemies that will split into the game. And it's your job to do a decent bit of crowd control in taking them out. In addition to the regular moves I mentioned, there's also a special attack that you can do where you can kind of, once you charge this up, your special gauge, you can trigger to send a wave of light orbs across the screen to just wreck as many enemies as possible. Good for your counter, your combo meter, and also just to knock out enemies that are probably keen to blocking you, but you don't want to use heavy attacks on them because it makes you feel too slow for the situation you're facing yourself with. At the end of every level, you'll be tasked with beating a boss. Unfortunately, in this case, I would say the majority of the bosses in this game aren't anything to really write home about. They're just like, you know, characters like yourself. Well, like characters from Phantom Breaker, the Phantom Breaker franchise, rather, that you can just maul if you're really capable of it. Though I'd wager on higher difficulty, which I did not engage with on this review, they probably give you a little bit more trouble. But on normal, nah, you'll breeze through pretty well. And that's perfectly fine. Eventually, you will clear the game, and that will be that. Or would it be? Because no, baby, this is Phantom Breaker Phantom Grail's Ultimate. So they added a few things to this game once you've completed it to get you to engage with it further. For example, once you've beaten the game, you unlock a lot more characters, though not for story mode, but you do unlock them for the versus mode and also the what I can best be described as like the arcade mode of sorts. So you can just kind of do co-op with your friends. And the characters are pretty much enemy characters in the game. So maybe a couple new ones in there. I couldn't tell you because I didn't go through every, because again, there's 24 characters that I unlock. There's a lot. But there are a number of ones that you want to play through with, some of which have, you know, similar skill trees to the other characters, others of which don't. They've added more music to the game. By more music, I mean the exact same tracks from the first game, but they remixed them and gave them more, you know, high quality studio tunage. I'm going to tell you, though, to be perfectly frank, I'm a big fan of FM synth, so I just stuck with the original soundtrack. I would usually go into a level, go to the remix version, let it play for a bit, and then go right back to the old one. Not because it's bad quality, quite the contrary, but just because I like the original soundtrack. I've used to bump to it on YouTube from time to time, so I have a fondness for it. They've added these items that you can find in future playthroughs where you can basically beat enemies up and they'll sometimes drop them. And when they drop them, you can equip them on the skill setup screen to either change one of your special attacks or give you a passive buff, like more money or more experience. That is largely the thing that they changed about the game. But with that said, Don't Fix If It Ain't Broke would have already been in place, and they just happened to make it a better game. I didn't even mention the fact that the characters, when you beat up enemies, you do get experience points from wrecking their faces. And at the end of every level, or on the skill setup screen on the default base menu, you can go to that character and spend skill point, experience points that you earn to level your character up. Unfortunately, though, not necessarily the most evil thing, but every character's skill tree is pretty much the same general layout of where the tiles are. Whether or not those tiles are different, though, that I don't know. But every character I've used is pretty much the same skill tree. But with that said, if you like a certain character, you're going to want to level them up anyway. Because why wouldn't you? You like the character. Don't lie to me. But that, and you can also spend skill points to level up their stats in attack, defense, and speed. So if you're the type that likes playing through games and unlocking more bits of each character you play as, basically giving you more to do with each one, there's a lot to do here. Because, you'll just choose a character, play with them, unlock all their stats and all their skills, and then do it with another character. But that's a good incentive for you to play the game over and over again, whereas a lot of beat-em-ups, they give you four or five characters that have static skills, and when they're done, you're done. This game gives you a lot more than that, and the ability to level them up. One might argue that the enemies don't have the same sort of personality as, say, a Streets of Rage character has, but your mileage may vary. There's some pretty cool enemy designs in this game. Though, admittedly, there's also some really strange ones, like the fat guy with the weird mask that throws burgers at you, but I don't know. Whatever. With that said,
that was
though...
me.
Chris, what are you doing in my Phantom Breaker? what are you doing in my peanut butter? So, with that said, this game does hold up. It's still a lot of fun. Music's still good, and they made it better for those who don't like FM synth and whatnot. Music's still good. Gameplay's still good. They give you more of those things. The only thing I wish they added was new levels. There are alternate versions of levels that you can unlock during plays of stages. But I would have been happier to have more levels. It's the same kind of complaint I had about, what's that game? Dragon's Crown, which was big back in the day. I just wish they put more levels in the game. Even if it was just a new background with different enemies in it. It could have fooled me, so whatever. But with that said, the game is still solid. I think it's worth a play. I would have given it a buy it back in the day, so obviously I'm going to give it a buy it right now, but Joshua still asked the question so I could say it officially and be done.
Well, it's $24.99. Give us your opinion.
I think it's a buy it. Worth your time.
It is on my wish list. So I like the fact that there's 8 player online, too.
Yeah, and this harkens back to the good old Guardian Hero days, because even though you couldn't do 8 players in the normal gameplay mode, you could beat each other up in the arena that way. So I do appreciate that more games are trying to get that out there.
All right, well, moving on. Next game to talk about is Willow Guard, developed and published by Mytel. Released April 10th on Steam for $15.99. Willow Guard is a single-player, story-driven fantasy RPG that combines dungeon-crawling action gameplay with choice-based interactive fiction. Our friend Andy Sperry covered this one, and he sent us over a recording of his review. So, Andy, take it away.
Hey, SML Podcast. This is Andy Sperry doing a review for Willow Guard. Willow Guard is a story-driven fantasy RPG that combines a bunch of elements to enhance the gameplay. But honestly, I would say maybe too many ideas were thrown out and things felt like they came up a little short. I'm going to try not to rag on the game too much, but I feel like a lot of things could have been better sorted out, or even developed into their own game. But as a reminder, this is just my experience with Willow Guard, and it could be exactly the type of game that you're looking for. In Willow Guard, you'll take the role of Gueros, the Willow Guard, who is both grumpy and empathetic. A good comparison would be a badger cosplaying as Henry Cavill in The Witcher. All the characters in this game are animals, by the way. And the story revolves around both the rise in monster attacks near a remote village in Woykos, and the strange connection you have to the goddess of the moon, who visits you in a dream. Ooh. And with all rogue heroes, you're out to find answers. The game plays to two main parts, battles and interactions, through semi-visual novel-style narration and areas of exploration and combat. So first off, you'll use what's called a focus skill to interact with areas of interest in different locations. Based on how much focus you have, you can make choices on what to investigate and gain more knowledge on, leaving some choices out of reach. Based on what you've chosen, you'll shape the story and change oncoming interactions with fellow creatures. I felt like the outcome was usually the same, but based on what you chose, determined bonus skills around an inclination, which are creed, empathy, focus, instinct, and neuroticism. These usually only change what you say in conversation, but it didn't really feel like it changed the overall outcome of the story. I wasn't too impressed with the story, to be honest, and tried my best to push towards the combat side of the game, though. Combat is the whole other side to the game, and felt like it could have been its own thing, really. While a bit janky at times, it had a very simplistic take on combat. Then they added cards to the game, so why does every game feel like they need to put cards in it? It doesn't make anything better. Sometimes it just confuses things. But as you go through levels, you'll clear out areas full of creatures with what looks like a chronic wasting disease. You'll boost a meter on the bottom of the screen that will pop up a choice of cards for you to add to your inventory. Deck building is done outside of combat, but really just gives you a few choices to add to your movesets. Dash and sword attack are your main ones. And then I usually filled the other two empty slots with a heal or a ranged attack pretty much every single time. Why I couldn't just have that the whole time and save the cards for another game, I'm not really sure. But there's also simple puzzle elements to the levels, like tap all these things or find that thing. They're a little bit, you know, simple and questy, but overall kind of lackluster and repetitive on their own. There's also armor upgrades, which are a part of the game too, but really nothing amazing. And honestly, most of the upgrades are a little bit grindy to get all the elements to upgrade them. But Willowguard has a nice art style and music direction to it. I just personally felt like it plays to a very specific style of Steam player, and I unfortunately was not one of those. It's kind of a meh game for me, but it could be a yes for you. I would say go check it out for yourself. It's really not a bad game. I enjoyed the art. I'm sure the story is fantastic to somebody who is really into that kind of thing. I'm just more of a action type player, so yeah. In the meantime, though, I will leave you with this. A little joke, dude. What sort of medal would you give a woodland creature? A badger of honor. Get it? Love you, SML. Peace.
All right, moving on. Next game is Warside, developed by Lava Bird, published by First Break Labs, released April 14th on Steam for $26.99. Welcome to Warside, the fast-paced turn-based tactics game. With a single-player story campaign, multiplayer support, and a built-in map editor, the fight for victory never ends. Choose your commander, assemble your forces, and battle your way to victory. Brunel, what is Warside?
Did I say I didn't want to break because I changed my mind? So, Warside, what exactly is Warside? So, Warside is what you get when someone says, I want Advanced Wars, and Nintendo ain't doing it, so I'm going to try to do something that is like it, but with improvements that I see as improvements. And what you get is, in a lot of ways, a very good product. You basically have access to two primary modes. You have the skirmish mode, or not skirmish, like versus mode, where basically you can play multiplayer with other people if you can get them around to play. And the other mode is the campaign mode, where you will go across a map, engaging in various battles. You can go back to old battles if you want to and play them on higher difficulties. But for the most part, you're going from level to level and engaging the pretty base narrative, though in their defense, Advanced Wars didn't have much of a narrative either. But I digress. And you're taking on the opposition. There are, I'll say, like four different entities or nations in this game, and those nations are pretty much battling with each other. And at any given level in the campaign, you are playing as one of the commanding officers for one of those nations, and your goal is to pretty much rout the opposition. This is done by purchasing and applying units to trounce other enemy units until they have nothing left. Units can come in quite a few forms. They come in things like infantry, tanks, light items such as buggies, and boats, planes, you name it, they got it. In fact, this game has a fair number more types of units in it than Advance Wars did, even at its peak of unit count. That comes for a number of reasons. One being that they just have more units in their base form, and the other reason is because the different nations have units that are unique only to them, which makes it so there's a different bit of a reason to use one CO over another from a different region. Yeah, base obvious example that pretty much everybody and their mom is using as an example because of how much it stands out. The Blue Nation has what's basically called like a Rhino tank. The tank itself does very little damage. However, the tank's specialty is that it can actually push units away from where they are currently stationed at, which is pretty good. For example, if you want to run a Rhino head first into an environment that has, like, say, an artillery or a rocket, you can just push it away so that now it's out of range of all your units that you're trying to move them in. Pretty good way, even though you might end up sacrificing that Rhino to everyone swarming it the next round. In addition to that, if the Rhino pushes a tank or a unit into water, it just kills it outright. If you push a unit into a mountain, it kills it outright. So it makes you question where you leave units at the end of a turn when you see a Rhino on the field. And then there's other types of units that are particular, such as one that lets you kind of run ramshot behind enemy lines at the exchange of being a unit that can get decimated by most other units because it's not very defensively strong. That's one of the things I think about the game is pretty awesome. Another thing about the game I think is pretty cool is the way that they changed two key elements that you were familiar with in Advance Wars. For example, capturing buildings. Originally in Advance Wars, if you wanted to capture a facility, facilities, by the way, are the buildings that allow you to generate revenue so that you can construct units from factories. To do that in Advance Wars, you had to send an infantry unit on top of a building and then let it sit there until it drops an equivalent of 10 HP worth of strength to a building, which then allows you to capture it and get revenue from it. In this game, however, while you can actually place a unit on top of a building, so that's not the requirement, by placing a unit adjacent to the building, as long as it's an infantry type unit or infantry, family of unit, you will immediately capture the building and you will immediately start getting revenue from it on the subsequent turns. However, it starts at a very low 2 HP of capture strength. In this turn, this time, any other unit, any opponent unit can roll up on it, even a tank or whatever, can roll up on this building and just take it out and pretty much remove your ability to control it. So it requires you to defend them that much more. However, with that said, even though facilities and whatnot can, remove HP from buildings, only infantry can actually capture them. So that still makes infantry units important, despite the fact that it didn't sound like that at first, blah. In addition to that, constructing vehicles now, due to the fact that you don't have to be physically on the building to engage the buildings, now when you construct buildings or units such as infantry, tanks, boats, whatever, you release them to the side of the building, not on top of the building, which means if you have the money, you can technically build 4 units from one, facility at any given time. They still can't move into the next turn, but hey, 4 units in one round is pretty freaking sweet and can be a good way to, flood the enemy side with the infantry if you have the money for it and just need to get guys out in the field to, pad the forces out a bit. They changed a couple of weird things too in regards to like how the building works, because like they added actual buildings in the water that can be captured to generate revenue. Whereas in the old games, water combat was purely combat. In this game, there are units that can capture buildings in the water and they generate revenue. And you can even use water capturing infantry type units to capture facilities that are on the outskirts of the water. So not a bad way to go about it if you have the means to do so. And it adds an extra level of strategy to the game because now naval combat isn't just about the combat. Now there's also some area control out there too. I think that's pretty good. With that said, there are some odd things to this game, which makes me feel weird about how I would if I could recommend it or say give it a wait and see. And that is that there are some things I noticed while playing the game that annoyed me that makes me wonder if the game has more to go. For example, aside from doing what I learned it in the campaign levels early on, you can't look at what the CO's strengths are or what their actual CO powers do. So If you gain the strength, the ability to activate the CO power, you can trigger it, and then you can scroll to the area on the board where it would be effective, and then bam, it would do its job. But if you're just unsure of what that power does, and you don't want to burn an entire gauge to find out, you can't. If you're curious about what your opponent's CO power is, and they haven't used it yet, but you want to try to prepare yourself for it, can't do that either. There's no reference to see what those things do. Just have to see and find out and hope for the best. It'd be nice if they let you look at what the COs are like in, like, say, a sub-menu or something. In addition to that, in Advance Wars, I don't like comparing the games, but in this case I have to, and you'll get it in a second. In Advance Wars, when enemies or when units attacked each other, they did two things. One, they burned fuel moving from point to point, and you had to refuel them and reload or to refuel them using AP some artillery vehicles. In addition to that, if they engaged in combat, they used ammunition. And eventually, if you ran out of primary ammunition, you had to switch to your auxiliary ammunition, which was weaker, but at least it didn't make you a sitting duck on the field and let you be able to do anything. This game seems to have indications that it intends to use both of those things, but the actual numbers on those meters don't change. They stay full ammo, and the fuel remained at 80. So it made me kind of feel weird about, is this something that they mean to fix later, and they didn't mean to yet? Because it's clear that they intended for it to be a thing, because it's actually in the menu screen for the vehicle, so it just seems like a thing that either they either take it out or add it in fully. I don't know. And the last issue I personally had with it was, though I enjoyed the battles themselves, one thing that I kind of miss is the ability to just kind of have like free-for-all battles, as in like battles that aren't associated with the main game. A lot of times in the Advance Wars, they have like that weird like side mode where you could have like, there's like 20 or 30 maps that had a predefined commanding officer and a predefined map layout, and it's like, okay, win this battle. Potentially win it next number of turns or whatever. But this game has nothing like that. The only maps you're going to get are maps made in Level Creator, which I don't even know if they let you use those maps to do skirmishes, because I'm not messing with level creating. Or you have to just play the campaign levels over and over again. I feel like there was a missed opportunity there, and I hope that there's an intent to patch it, because even the menu screen has a square that is empty, and the options that are there kind of go over and then down, which means there's a square sitting there that's empty, which could totally be end up being populated by a skirmish mode if they decide to add it later on. I could totally picture them doing that. But as it stands now, it's not there, and it'd be awesome if it were. And the last thing I don't like is, as dumb as it may sound, I'm not too big on the character art, but that's neither here nor there, because if the game itself is enjoyable, I can see myself getting around and ignoring it. Though I will admit, character art is pretty much why I got into Advance Wars to start with, and believe it or not, that is probably the first military tactical game that is not like Ogre Battle that I ever got into and enjoyed, with the exception of, I guess, maybe Military Madness, but I digress. So it would go a long way. But despite that personal nick and the things I mentioned before, the core gameplay right now is perfectly fun, and I can totally see room for improvement if they knock out some of those other bits. So with that said, I'm not going to give this game a deny by far, because that would imply that the game is bad, and this game is not bad by any means. With that said, someone might have heard the price point that you mentioned earlier in this review and go, if the game feels incomplete, would I seriously pay $24.99 for it? And my answer to that is, well, that's a very good question. Would you? Because I feel
it's $26.99, not $24.99.
Oh, no, deny. I'm kidding. No, no. But with that said, comes the big Joe question.
It is a $27 game. I am looking over the Steam reviews, and a lot of people are in agreement that it just feels unfinished. So is this something that people should invest in now? Like, a lot of people are saying they should have released as early access, so we'll just treat this review like early access. Is this something people should invest in now, add to the wish list, ignore it? What should people do?
I can't treat it like early access, only because even though I guess a developer could just abandon a game in that capacity, I feel like early access at least gives you the hope that they will come back and do more with it, whereas finished game says finished game until otherwise noted. So, but with that said, I still wouldn't give it a denied. I would give it a try because let's just say, for example, they just left this game in the dust, but then it got a deep discount. Well, then I think you'd have fun with it in a deep discount. Not a big deal. But I want to say at least try it because the game that is there is still fun. I did not dislike it by any means. I had fun playing it. But I don't feel in good faith saying give this a buy knowing that there's bits to it that are just clearly not there.
Makes sense. All right, moving on. Next game is Skies Above, developed by Hungry Dingo and Flynn's Arcade. Published by Flynn's Arcade, released April 17th on Switch for $7.99. A fast-paced action-packed pixel art game where you have to help a Leviathan reach space by defending it from an endless robot army. That sounds so cliche, really does. Every game has that story anymore. You know, Leviathans and robots. Chris, tell us about Skies Above.
Ale as old as time. I kept, every time I would think about the friggin' title of this game, I would think of Kung Pao Enter the Fist. And then I realized it was Stars Above, not Skies Above. But I would be like, Skies Above. Anyway, real Kung Pao heads will know what I'm talking about here.
I haven't seen that in a while.
I love it. It's such a good movie. Yeah, so Skies Above is a action, I guess you'd call it a roguelike, maybe. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, you go into a gameplay loop and make as much progress as you can, and then when you die, you get sent back to the hub, and, like, I guess it's not roguelike because you keep all the stuff that you, all the, money and I don't know, jewels, whatever these items are. I guess they're spiritual force of some kind. When you get back to the hub and then use it to upgrade yourself so that you have a better loadout or better stats for the next time. So, I don't know, roguelite, maybe? But yeah, you play as, what's his name? Eldra, I think, is his name. An old guy who, Eldra is the name. Looks like an old guy. I mean, he looks like a guy with a beard. I can't really tell. The graphics are, I mean, it's pixel art and he's very small. Like, it's a very small character. So it kind of looks like a guy with a white head of hair and a beard. And your task is to basically, without going, it gives you the whole story right at the beginning of the game, so I don't need to go over it too much, but basically there's flying whales. There's an evil corporation that's after the flying whales, and you got to protect this flying whale from orbs that they send out and other types of shenanigans that happen, and try to get through different phases. Or, you know, like, basically get to, like, a finish line, and then there's a total of presumably four finish lines, or maybe five before the end, just based on the achievements, because, yeah, this game is a little hard, so I definitely did not get all the way to the end of it. Your moveset, for the most part, is pushing B to jump, and, of course, you can do a double jump, because this is an indie game. And there's also a reticule that you can, like, move around, like, with the left stick. So, like, if you're running to the right and you hold the stick to the right or left, then you're aiming to the right or left. That is both going to determine, that is basically going to determine what direction you are going to basically super jump into. Like, your jumps are extremely rocket powered. So as you're jumping across the back of this whale, you're basically trying to jump into the orbs that come down, and you'll latch onto them. And if you push the B button, then your character will explode them. And then if you are aimed in the right direction when that happens, then you can move on to the next bomb and get a combo. And that's good because these orbs are constantly shooting at this whale who has a life bar that's like being, you know, perpetually sloughed off as they get hit by lasers and stuff. And of course, once the whale loses all of its HP, then you are back where you started. Again, with all the coins and spiritual power that you accumulated by destroying or picking up things. And then, yeah, like, basically there's a lot of stuff that unlocks as the game progresses as well. So it's not just, like, buying items or something like that. But yeah, I'll get back to that. Like, basically the other half of the action as far as, like, what your character can do is that he has a hook. So the hook is activated with the right trigger, the shoulder button, and it allows you to basically grapple onto an enemy that you're aiming at. So, like, you're sailing straight into the air because you jump straight into the air, right? Well, you don't have to wait until you land again, you know, and waste precious seconds to try and get that jump again where you can, like, destroy that orb. You can target the orb with the hook button and then immediately go straight to it. Or you can actually press the R and L shoulder buttons at the same time, and that kind of hooks you back to the whale. And again, like, these are all movements you have to make very quickly, and you have to be conservative about your, like, jumps and stuff, because, you know, the hook sometimes isn't going to work if you've already used up too many kind of actions before landing. You can also slide, which that helps you pick up things. I haven't found another use for it, but I do see that there's unlockable moves like sliding hits, and, like, there's all kinds of other moves that get unlocked throughout the course of the game. And like I said, there's also in the hub center, there is a tree, and you feed it those blue spiritual force orbs that you sometimes pick up, and then you gain levels. And as you gain levels, more things unlock. You can also purchase upgrades to essentially the whale with the money that you pick up. So you can buy, like, more life for the whale. You can buy, you know, the increased speed at which it charges up, quote unquote, which basically that's the game timer. So, you know, you win you basically win as soon as your whale is fully charged up. That's how you pass the stage. And of course, that timer is going up while their life is going down from getting blasted so much. And then there's a greed stat that increases the number of the, I guess they're called shards that you collect. And so that's just, you know, kind of investing in getting better gains per round. There's other characters that you can talk to of mysterious origins. And, you know, there's also these whale-like spirits that you can, if you grab them with your hook when they float by, you can unlock them. And if you unlock enough of them, then apparently something good will happen, and that unlocks something else. There's just, like, a ton of stuff that just keeps unlocking. But essentially, the gameplay loop is that you are riding on the back of a whale who is traveling towards a goal, and you just got to keep those orbs off of him. And yeah, the game is presented in a very beautiful pixel art style. Definitely reminds me of, like, Chained Echoes and, like, some of those much nicer pixel art indie games that we see now, you know, more of nowadays. I'm really pleased with the art. The music's good, although you have to kind of crank it to really get it, because it, you know, it by default is not particularly loud. Also has a cute doggo in the hub world for no reason at all. So that's really nice. Yeah, it just kind of keeps track of your stats. You know, keeps track of characters as you meet them. And, you know, your overall playtime and things like that. There's not much else to it, really. It's just that, you know, you want to, you know, you just got to keep doing that gameplay loop and get a little better each time, either through items or through skill, and discover stuff along the way.
Nice. Well, it is an $8 game. What's your verdict?
Oh, yeah, $8 is, like, that's practically a fuck it, why not? Like I said, it's a beautiful game. You just have to kind of, like, be into, like, the specific kind of arcade-style action that it presents, which I don't really have an analog for. I don't really know what this is like, you know. It's definitely, yeah, it'll feel kind of familiar when you play it, and it does take a little bit to, like, get good, like, you know, at it enough to survive for any amount of time in a particular round. But like I said, there's a lot here, and for $8, if this seems interesting to you, it'll be well worth it to pick it up.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right, next up is Snow Squall, developed by Viddy Games, published by Dolores Entertainment, released April 18th on Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch, PS4, PS5 for $9.99. Escape the snowy nightmare or be trapped forever? Or call. Aki, what is Snow Squall?
Okay, Snow Squall is an incredibly short game that you can beat in about 10-ish minutes, if that. You play a secret agent who fucking knows. You're in a helicopter to deliver a battery to some secret science-y place who knows what the hell they do either, because it's secret agent shit, who knows. Well, your helicopter goes down, because, who the hell knows? And now you have to drag this battery over, oh yeah, you're in, like, Alaska or Antarctica or some crazy shit where it's super, super cold. So you have to solve a bunch of tiny little puzzles around to get this battery where it ought be and get all the parts necessary to actually use it and the like. This is a pretty short first-person puzzle game with one single instance of first-person shooting. And the puzzles in this are, you know, hey, you have to find this fuse, now you have to figure out where it goes into the only fuse box that exists. Oh, this generator needs gas, let's go put the gas can here. Oh, how do we figure out the code, the passcode to get in here? Well, it's written on some things close by, and you have to use a fire to melt the ice over two of the numbers. The third one, basically, isn't covered with ice to indicate that the other two require, you know, the ice being melted. It's great. And yeah, it is a very quick little game. There's two different endings, technically, that you can get, as well as a ranking system. The ranking system is purely seemingly based on how many secret little briefcases of money that you find, and I think there's five of them in the entire game. There's an achievement for beating the game while collecting all of those items in under... It's either under 10 or under 30 minutes. I think it was under 30 minutes. I did it in like 11-ish minutes. And the world record for beating that game is like just over 2 minutes. Not with collecting everything, but still, yeah. So it's a pretty short little game. Your first time through, depending on how bad you are at puzzles, may take you a good long time, as Bree found out and got really angry about. So yeah,
you snorted.
Yes, I did, because it's funny. And yeah, that's really all there is to it. There's not a lot to say about this, because again, like, none of the puzzles are particularly hard. Most of it is just keeping yourself warm. You have to get to fire sources so you don't freeze to death in the game. And that's the only reason it takes any significant amount of time, because you step away from a fire source for more than like 10 seconds and you're running the risk of some bad shit happening. So you have to constantly be going back and forth to fires and shit like continuously throughout the entirety of this game. And that really slows it down. But other than that, it's a very quick, simple game to beat.
Cool. Well, it is $10. What do you say?
Sure, why not? It's simple enough, especially if you're an achievement hunter. This is a good, easy 100%. I don't know how many people are going to be particularly interested in this outside of achievement hunters, honestly, but I think it's fine. It's an okay game.
All right, sounds good. One final game to talk about tonight is Mega Knockdown, developed and published by D-Hamster, originally released back in 2022 on Steam Early Access for $9.99, just recently updated on April 3rd, a fighting game where the action only moves when you do. Plan your next move, then strike, evade, and punch. Knock him down and press the advantage, fight colorful hand-drawn characters, challenge your friends to an epic battle of wits. Pernell, what is Mega Knockdown?
Well, this is going to be an interesting one to review, but when you mentioned to me, it drew my interest, because as a person who plays board games and tabletop games, there have been a couple games that have attempted to recreate the feeling of a fighting game, but with a more methodical pacing. Games like Yomi or Battlecon, for example, both of which I have played and enjoyed. So the idea of someone taking that concept back to a video game format, though I guess technically someone might say, well, Yomi was a video game too. And I'm like, eh, after it was a card game, so leave me alone. So the idea of someone taking this and putting it back to the video gamescape as an original game made me interested. And that's what I'm here to talk about today. So imagine a fighting game that has all the general rules of a fighting game. Basically, the combos, the special attacks, parrying, grabs, all that stuff. But instead of being reactionary and to the minute on timing and, you know, reactionary speeds, instead the game allows you to do all these things methodically, allowing you to choose your inputs and amount of time that is reasonable to you, though there is still a clock at the top unless you change the setting. And then after your opponent makes a move, you then combine the two moves to have an output, and then the winner of that output does something. You'll end up with this game. And suffice it to say, this engages in a pretty interesting puzzle. So to give an example, just to lay out the general format of the game, you have a light, medium, and heavy attack button, and you have a guard button, and of course also a throw button. On any given turn, the game will be essentially paused, and you have to input a direction and one of those buttons. That is it. And once you've both input one, the game will play those things out. They also display the game, the hit boxes on the screen. So let's say, for example, you did an attack using forward and heavy, and that particular character has a special for that combination that sends an attack three spaces out. You'll see the animation go out. You'll see three red boxes to indicate that these three spaces are now being engaged by the attack. And if they happen to collide with one of your green spaces, which is your hitbox, boom, you're taking damage, unless you did a guard or whatever to counter that. The game will play these things out, and it does get pretty interesting and technical, so much so there's like a 21 or so panel tutorial for the game, which you will use a few times, doubly so if you're not particularly familiar with, you know, fighting game jargon. But don't get me wrong, they're not like intensive. It's just basically give you step by step. Here is a guard. Here is how you do a reverse guard. So they kind of step on all the notes. If you're anything like me, you'll go through the tutorial, think you're ready for the game, get your ass beat a few times, go back to the tutorial and do it again, and go, this time will be different. And then it is, but you don't beat the game. But you keep playing. Because, like I said, the interesting thing about this game is that you might have been, if you're like me and have said to yourself, man, I'd probably be so much better at fighting games if I didn't have to worry about complicated move inputs and timing those inputs to the millisecond of another player's attack. Well, you don't have that excuse here. The moves are very straightforward. Even the specials are very straightforward. There's no super meter to engage with. And it truly does come down to, could you outplay your opponent? That is Yomi at his absolute core. So, with that said, I think the game is pretty awesome. Like, even if you feel like you heard me talk about this and you thought to yourself, why the hell would I play a game that is slow and methodical like that? My response to that is, don't knock it till you've tried it. I do think it'd be pretty cool if they expanded on this game more, added some more characters and whatnot, because as it stands now, there's only a total of like seven or so. I think more, sorry, but I was talking about it. There's six characters total in this game. So there could totally be more added down the line if there is a, I guess if they feel like there's a reason to do so. But with that said, I think it's worth it. And the game has online, so you can play online with other people and have this exact same exchange with them there. It's just worth it. It's a good time. And it is an unexpected game in that sense, whereas I was not expecting a game like this, and that says a lot. Characters and all that, I'm not going to go into detail on what I think of the characters, because that's subjective. I would just say, me personally, there's characters here that I like, and that's enough for me. Just like any fighting game, really. So,
all right, well, it's a $10 game. What do you think?
I think it's an easy buy. It does something different. It does it different in a way where it doesn't feel unpolished. It feels like they put effort into it, and it shows. And it's a good game. And I would like to see more things like this whether on this budget or, heaven forbid, a freaking like double A budget or something like that. But I like that. I think this game is great, and I like to see more like it. So I give it a buy.
Awesome. All right. Well, that is it for this episode. We made it through. Thanks to you three for being here, hanging out the whole time.
Woohoo, baby.
Music. We are going to play The Hot Pink of Blues from Final Fantasy VI from our good friend Prince of Darkness. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Hot Pink of Blues.
Tony Dickinson is always good stuff.
I do have a small question real quick before we go, though I could technically ask it offline too, but has anybody here played that blue, what's it called, like Blue Empire or Blue Palace? That's what it's called.
Uh-uh.
Have you ever played that?
Never. I've barely even heard of it except on Blue Sky.
Ooh, Blue Palace on Blue Sky. I'm really curious about it because it seems like it's getting a lot of praise. But at the same time, like, I look at it and I'm like, this doesn't seem like the kind of game I'd want to play. And yet, all indications online are saying that it is that kind of game. I just need to get my toe into it to experience it for myself. But
you mean Blue Prince? No one here has played.
That is what I meant. God damn it, I'm so sleepy. Blueprint. The game with the freaking, like, where it generates the different rooms. You have to engage them as puzzles to find one special room or whatever.
I have not started that yet, but I shall be probably within a week or so.
Oh, you got it? Okay.
It's on Game Pass.
It's on Game Pass.
Oh, that'll do it.
And on PlayStation Plus.
I think you might still have Game Pass. I should check. So maybe that'll be an excuse just to use it.
Yeah, you could play Blueprints, and you could play Oblivion Remastered that just came out today.
Oblivion, wow. Man, there's a shocker. Oblivion was a pretty awesome game back in the day, though.
So. Yeah, just got a fun little remaster today, released on PC, Xbox, and PS5. It's a big one, 120 gig.
I wonder if they kept that glitch in it to where the longer you play it, the less likely you are to be able to complete it because it slows down.
I think they updated
it. Was it a memory leak or something? Issues.
Oh, that's a
shame. Was that a memory leak? That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, it was a serious memory leak in the game. The longer your total game time that you put into it, the less likely you'd be able to beat it because it would just constantly slow down the game just a little bit. And so once you got to, like, I think it was like 300 hours or something, like 200 to 300 hours, it was fucked.
Oof.
It was funny.
Yeah.
Fun.
You gotta rush the game.
All right. Does anyone have any final words to end the show?
Even Fluffers. Those are words. There it is.
I didn't even hear it.
I think
so. I concur.
Still didn't hear it.